Welcome to Federal Insights for May, a discussion on artificial intelligence and data, sponsored by Hitachi Vantara Federal.
Artificial intelligence and machine learning have emerged as important tools for modernizing systems and simplifying federal process, but they require the right data and lots of it for training the algorithms. For sound approaches to data in the AI and ML context, I spoke with the group lead for digital and software engineering at the Idaho National Laboratory, Chris Ritter.
So artificial intelligence, right, the ultimate goal, right, is to make computers think like humans do and be able to predict what a human would predict or do better than a human would predict at predicting a functionality. Whereas machine learning really is about having machines that are pre-programmed be able to do some analysis on their own, right? So a great example is Google's new innovations in image recognition, right? So when you go and you fill out a CAPTCHA online, right, you're helping train those new algorithms, right, of is this a cat or is this a dog, right? And over time, that algorithm is learning, right, through what's called a deep neural network to discover what that item that is. But that is not general artificial intelligence, right, scaling that up to be able to predict, for example, operating a nuclear reactor autonomously is a little bit different than being able to recognize between a cat or a dog. And those are really the three primary areas that we talk about when we talk about artificial intelligence and the prediction algorithms, where a lot of the existing research is in getting the data curated and getting the data in a format that's possible to get those scale-up advantages and to apply machine learning to some of our complex problems in the energy domain.
And we're going to get into all of that detail on the data, but I just wanted to ask you a question about the algorithms, because lately people have been dismissing that as, oh, no big deal, just an algorithm. It's all about the data. But an algorithm, is that just a fancy word for a block of if-then logic?
No, it's a little different. So there's really two major types, right? So there's the deep neural networks, right, which kind of try to recognize your brain, right? And they're actually a black box. So what a lot of people don't understand is we can't easily audit what's occurring, right? The computer actually on its own eventually builds a model, right, that describes what it thinks the system looks like. And then the secondary approach is the approach that probably all of us are more familiar with. Probably most people have been to stats class, right, in high school or college, right? And you remember linear and logistic regression, maybe, if you think about it. And that is really the secondary approach. And that we call explainable or transparent artificial intelligence. What that means is it's mathematical, right? So it's completely auditable. And we can apply some penalized regression techniques to those areas, and you can make that a more novel technique. And what a lot of people don't think about is if you have a ton of data, image recognition is a great example, right? Then DNNs, these deep neural networks, are a great approach. But if you have less data, sometimes it's better to apply a common statistical approach. And you might say, well, but that's easy, that's simple. But there's some major advantages, right? It's gonna run faster, and also we can audit it, right? And so we know what's actually gonna happen. So you can think about use cases where there are life-critical safety systems, right? Where you want that. You want that ability to know what it's going to do and why it did it. And then we can always audit it later, right? To discover the reason behind it. So those are the two primary approaches we take. I guess the third you could say, if we wanna add one, right? Would be that if-then logic. So I would call that heuristics. So pre-coding what you think it is going to do. So, you know, that you can simulate some AI-like behavior with that, but really the computer isn't thinking, right? The programmer is thinking about what you want it to accomplish, right? And then you're basically having it run through a series of if-then statements to discover that.
All right, and let's review some of the types of work that you're doing at the Idaho National Laboratory in this whole area of machine learning and AI.
Yeah. So a lot of our work in my domain has been around this concept called digital engineering. And so digital engineering is a Department of Defense term that's 3 or 4 years old now that has been made up, and we borrowed it for our applications in energy. And so it's around 5 key tenets. So the first is the idea that you're going to use a model. So what's a model, right? Well, a model to me is data, right? So it's all about getting data curated. And it changes the paradigm shift, right? So right now, what you can do is you can do an unstructured approach, right? So you can think about a Word document or a PDF, right? And you can have an algorithm parse that Word document or PDF and turn it into structured data. But that's pretty challenging, right? That gets into what's called natural language processing, and that's a whole subdomain, which we can go down if you want. But then the other approach is to change the way that people work and have them produce data into data buckets that then we can already mine, right? And that's the approach that we've really been taking at INL, is to change the way we work rather than try to make the algorithm smarter. Let's make the humans change their pattern a little bit. The second tenet of digital engineering is the idea that you're going to build this authoritative source of truth. And really all that means is we want to get the data into one place and we want to start connecting it together. So you can think about kind of like a web, right, of information, right? And the internet, as we all know, right, is a bunch of hyperlinks, right? So basically we're trying to make all those links together across the data, right, across all of our different silos, right? So you're taking your engineering data, you're taking your data from your cost and scheduling folks, you're taking your data from your physicists, and you're linking it all together in one ecosystem, if you will.
Yes, and just a point on that, if you do that successfully, then maybe some major errors in, say, mechanical engineering can be avoided. I'm thinking of the famous collapse of the walkways, where instead of using one rod, they used two rods, basic engineering 101 mistake, and 140 people got mushed as a result later on. If somehow there had been a network of data, someone could have said, no, you can't do that. Engineering 101.
Exactly. And so that's exactly what the approach is there. So we call that silent error. So what often happens too in like nuclear design or any complex design, right? So this isn't unique to nuclear. Look at complex aircraft for the same problem. And so you develop a requirement, right? It shall do this. And then you flow that requirement, right? The design, right? So then someone says, okay, well, here's how I'm going to implement it. They build a block diagram, right? Which is basically boxes and lines that describe it, right? And then they take that block diagram and they produce a CAD drawing. Then that CAD drawing eventually gets fabricated, right? Well, what happens is a lot of times those upper level requirements or those block diagrams change, right, throughout design, right? Requirements change, right? Needs change, especially during a long project, and they don't flow down properly. And so errors get made and miscommunicated all along the process. And those we call silent errors. And those silent errors, as you can imagine, can be 100 or 1,000x increased cost when you go to fix it during operations. And so the goal is to detect those as soon as possible. And so that's that spiderweb approach. So it increases safety and it also decreases the cost, right, to build these complicated engineering systems. So you're exactly right that that's the goal of that second tenet, right, this authoritative source of truth.
All right. And there are quickly three more tenets.
Yep. So the third tenet is really, they call it innovation. So we take that, you know, everyone takes that differently. What does that mean? So to us, we've been on the VTR project, the Versatile Test Reactor Program, incorporating a lot of university researchers into the project. So they're bringing in some of the novel AI techniques and applying, for example, so we mentioned that spiderweb approach, right? How can we detect when those links are incorrect? So the human is making the link, right? And humans make mistakes. So how do we know that those links are accurate? Well, we can apply machine learning, right, to discover when the link doesn't look correct. And then we'll have a human go reanalyze, is that link what we expected it to be? So that's one approach to AI at that level. So the second major area is digital twins. And so digital twins, what are they, right? They are the virtual representation of a physical asset. And so what they allow us to do is combine, right, these data webs, artificial intelligence, and visualizations, right, to help make decisions, typically for autonomous control or predictive maintenance. So autonomous control, right, you're making it so you're replacing some of the operators, right, with a computer algorithm, put simply. Predictive maintenance, you're trying to figure out when is a part going to fail before it fails, right, so you can replace it, so you can reduce downtime. And so digital twin research at the laboratory has been centered around a lot of different projects, but one that we will highlight called Magnet. And Magnet is actually a non-nuclear testbed. It's a small facility that is similar to what we call a microreactor. So these are very small. You could fit it in your truck bed, right, kind of reactor. And so what we're using that is as a testbed to make it possible to generate data streams, right, to predict different values and eventually autonomously control it. So right now that research is actually really hot off the presses, right? A lot of that research started back in November to work with the data. And right now we're able to predict temperature values across the item. And as that matures into the next year or so, we're thinking we'll get to some autonomous control aspects. And then eventually scaling that up to apply to real nuclear facilities. And that's the goal.
Chris Ritter, Group Lead for Digital and Software Engineering at the Idaho National Laboratory. We'll return with more of the interview after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
Hitachi Vantara Federal is built to support your mission and vision. We empower federal agencies in the digital domains that matter most: the data center, tactical and strategic data operations, and digital transformation. We bring together an unmatched portfolio of edge-to-core to cloud infrastructure, AI, and analytics that enable our customers' digital missions and propel our nation forward. Let us accelerate your data journey from infrastructure to advanced analytics. Contact Hitachi Vantara Federal today at HitachiVantaraFederal.com.
Welcome back to our interview with Chris Ritter, Group Lead for Digital and Software Engineering at the Idaho National Laboratory. Our topic is data and data management for AI and machine learning. And looking at these massive projects that you have going on then, just describe the data requirements that you have to make sure that the digital engineering actually produces usable real-world results. How do you curate the data and how do you manage it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So data curation, so we build these things that we call ontologies, which are basically blueprints for the data, or bins. So you can think about it like the old file folders of yore, right? Where you're literally trying to file the data into the right file box, right? And so we build these ontologies. It's more complicated than that, but that's the best way to think about it. And so the boxes we call classes, right? So you're gonna put these classes of data in the right locations, and then you're gonna put attributes on it. So what's on the piece of paper, right? We'll say that's your attributes, right? And then the real big novelty, right, is how are those pieces of paper linked? So each piece of paper is linked to another piece of paper. So a good example would be, you know, you might have a needs document, right, that says, I need this thing to do this operation, right? I need it to produce this much power for me. Well, how are you gonna do that? Well, this other document might describe how that's gonna happen. And so these ontologies, these data models, right, are what allows us to organize that data and curate it. And so for nuclear operations, we created this ontology called Diamond, which we've standardized across all of our applications as the consistent data model. So the idea is we use the same data model, whether you're building a sodium-cooled fast reactor or you're building a light water reactor, it doesn't matter. You're going to use the same key model. And so that data curation makes that possible.
Describe the data itself. What types of data, what formats is it in, and how big are the data sets? And do you use the same data sets over and over, or do you use the same Diamond ontology, but with different data sets depending on the particular problem?
That's a great question. So the types of data we have, I mentioned requirements. We have equipment, right? Basically equipment lists, right? Long lists of equipment. These facilities have thousands and thousands of parts, right? And then we also have geometry. So what is geometry, right? Geometry is what you would probably call CAD or computer-aided design files, right? 3D and 2D models, right? That describe what that facility is going to look like. And so so that's a big aspect of this, right? Is how do we describe the 3D and 2D point geometry, but link it back to those other aspects? And so we call that in the industry building information management. So those drawings describe the building or the facility. And then you may have heard of a term called product lifecycle management, or PLM, which typically describes the actual parts. And so we use a combination of these tool sets, right, to be able to capture that that idea. And then these ontologies sit at a higher level, right, to connect the data across these different domains, because typically all these different data sets are in different tools. Other data, cost, schedule information, risk, and then ultimately your plant operating data. So when the facility is operating, right, we want to be able to capture that data and know it came from this part. And so we can detect anomalies, right? And know that if this isn't something we've seen before, let's let the human take a look at this and see if this is correct.
So does the artificial intelligence piece come in when all of these parts and all of these subsystems are generating much more data than anyone can possibly look at hour by hour, minute by minute? It knows when there is an anomaly and will raise a red light on that big panel, if they still have those.
Yes. So I think that is generally the idea, right, is that during operations, predictive maintenance, right, has been applied, right, to plant operations, right? And so that's the idea that, like you said, a red light illuminates that, you know, a particular part, right, is likely to fail. And so in other applications and other industries, right, we're seeing predictive maintenance applied. And so we know that that technique is certainly possible. In the design side, right, being able to apply artificial intelligence during the design of an asset, I think we are still in the early stages of that idea. So there are certainly AI algorithms that are applied, you know, in early design, but there certainly isn't a here, write three statements on what you want this to be and then have the computer go generate a design for you. We are nowhere near that kind of capability today. What we are near is the ability to 3D print and additively manufacture parts. And so you could imagine the ability, if we know how to 3D print them, and we built neural networks, right, to use image recognition, which you talked about earlier, to detect where there are flaws. This is research at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Then eventually, right, maybe someone could design the part to 80%, and using that same kind of technique, let the computer remelt and refab that part until it gets to no flaws. So that's a possibility that we are starting to explore. And there's a manufacturing facility at Oak Ridge called the MDF, where they're doing that exact research. And they're using the Diamond ontology as well to capture that data.
But at some point, then, operational history can inform backwards to development of new systems, such that, you know, this pump seems to fail when this happens, or when it's in this sequence with other pumps, and maybe rearrange the sequence of pumps. I'm just making this up, but, you know, all the horror movies, it's always a pump. And so that kind of data can then keep feeding the intelligence, if you will, of what it is you're trying to accomplish for the next round.
Exactly. So capturing the historical data, and actually an interesting point to go down is some materials research. So we do what's called post-irradiation examination, or PIE, at Idaho National Laboratory. And you wouldn't think, but that generates petabytes of data per year. And interestingly, that data is currently not curated and kept around. And so that type of data, right, as we're able to curate that historical data, that's the goal, right, is to be able then to predict based on historical patterns, right, what this would do before we ever insert it for a test. And so petabytes of data, you know, is a lot of data, especially when you're generating that on an annual basis, right? And so storing that data appropriately, figuring out what to store long-term, these are complicated problems that we're, you know, researching how to solve right now.
Chris Ritter, Group Lead for Digital and Software Engineering at the Idaho National Laboratory. We'll return with the third and final segment of the interview after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
Hitachi Vantara Federal is built to support your mission and vision. We empower federal agencies in the digital domains that matter most: the data center, tactical and strategic data operations, and digital transformation. We bring together an unmatched portfolio of edge-to-core to cloud infrastructure, AI, and analytics that enable our customers' digital missions and propel our nation forward. Let us accelerate your data journey from infrastructure to advanced analytics. Contact Hitachi Vantara Federal today at HitachiVantaraFederal.com.
Welcome back to the third and final segment of our interview with Chris Ritter, Group Lead for Digital and Software Engineering at the Idaho National Laboratory. We've been discussing data and data management for AI and machine learning. Maybe give us an example, or a picture, rather, of how you do data management from a storage and retrieval point of view, because you are talking, as you say, a lot of data, and somewhere you need that one item of wisdom.
Yeah. So the fourth tenet, so we talked about the first three, is infrastructure and environment. And it's a tenet that I came from commercial industry, and I'll admit, I took for granted. It's much more difficult in the federal domain, especially when your data has to be kept extremely secure. And so in the federal domain, we need to store the data in a place that gives us that petabyte or zettabyte level storage, right? So where is that place? Well, Microsoft and Amazon and Google have spent billions of dollars, right, building these cloud computing environments. And so the national laboratories, we have these high-performance computers, which give us the computing power, but these cloud environments give us an additional capability, which is low latency. So that means it's quick to get from you to me in different sides of the country. And they give us the ability for very large storage and new algorithm use for deciding how to store that data. And so in the cloud, there's two types of storage. There's hot storage, which means I'm going to access that a lot. And there's cold storage, which means I'm just going to put that away. I don't know what I'm going to do with it yet, but I'm going to put it in a thing called, like, Glacier is what it's called in Amazon's terms. And just leave it there for a while until I might need that later. And I could pay a lot less to store that in Glacier, for I could put petabytes of data in there for a long time. And then maybe I don't know what I'm going to do with it. 5 years later, I decide, oh, if I combine that data with this data, I can predict this. And so that's the ultimate goal. So we about 2 years ago, kicked off an effort to be able to apply cloud computing to our nuclear system. So the Versal Test Reactor program was the spearhead of that, to make our reactor work. We thought we needed this cloud computing thing. And I will tell you, it is a lot more difficult to get an authority to operate in the cloud for nuclear data than it is for your commercial company that you operate. In my former life, we could just put the company credit card in and be in there in an hour. Here, it's like a year before you're able to stand up an environment like that. But once it was stood up, the novelty of being able to store and access that data, it totally changed the paradigm. And when combined with a 7 petaflop-ish total capability in high-performance computing, we've been able to see massive benefits. And we are right now working on a direct link between our high-performance computing environment and the cloud.
And when you have petabytes of data relating to many different types of projects, many historical periods, you know, going back however far, and it is scattered in multiple cloud locations and in supercomputing locations and thumb drives, people's drawers, whatever, that then raises the need to have some kind of a data directory, data dictionary. How do you manage the retrieval and even the knowledge of the data sets for the people that might need it?
Great question. So that is a combination. So we talked about the ontology, right, which is the blueprint. But then how do you store the data is what you're asking. So you take that ontology and you combine it with a graph-like National Laboratory. We built a system called DeepLinks, which has a cool name. But basically all it is a way to take that ontology and instantiate it into a list of what we call nodes, right, or basically items, and they're links to other items. And those databases can scale to really large data sets. And so we've been able to apply this deep linking idea to many different data sets and allow the same core software to work, whether it's a nuclear project, a battery project, or a geothermal project, as an example. That software could work in many different domains. The ontology that we've built to date has been nuclear specific, but the software is agnostic. And it leverages traditional relational database technologies, right, that have been proven for decades. It's just using it at a different scale and applying it with a graph-like model instead of a relational model.
And given the criticality of the work that you're doing, which is ultimately nuclear safety, then it would seem like the practices you're developing, if they're safe and reliable enough for that domain, they're probably good for any other domain.
Exactly. That's exactly the intent. And the fifth tenet, which maybe this is a good time to bring this in, is the how do you get this out to people, right? So I mentioned at the very beginning, we're changing the way people work. So how do you do that? How do you take, so this laboratory is 5,000 people, right? How do you take 5,000 people and change the way they do business? And so we have our Digital Innovation Center of Excellence, or DICE, which is a laboratory level function to see the practice and culture change across the laboratory. So you can apply the software correctly, right? So that you are getting the results you expect, or at least if you see results you don't expect, you know that those are probably incorrect and you need to retry. So another aspect of safety is understanding the training aspects and understanding that people know how to apply the technologies appropriately. So in DICE, we have 8 different pillars, 3 that are focused on AI, 1 that's focused on the computing aspects, right? What's the best model between high-performance computing and cloud? We have pillars that are focused on data, digital thread, right? How do we connect the data? A pillar on digital twinning, right? Applying it to the virtual physical world. And then we have pillars on decision science and visualization to see that forward. And so all we've kind of bridged our laboratory across, and it's not a organization, it's a virtual center, right? Which allows all the different organizations to collaborate together. And I think that's critical to organizations that are looking to apply this in the safety domain, is to get your company or your organization all on the same page. And you don't need to reorg your organization. You just need to get a place for those people to collaborate.
Chris Ritter, Group Lead for Digital and Software Engineering at the Idaho National Laboratory. To hear this interview again or share it with colleagues, please visit federalnewsnetwork.com and search Insights. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Federal Insights for May, a discussion on artificial intelligence and data, sponsored by Hitachi Vantara Federal on Federal News Network.
When we need help, we turn to government. When government needs help, they turn to Federal News Network. Federal News Network, helping feds meet their mission.